This is DJ Shy John here with the Kill Radio Weekly News in review. This morning we're going to do the format a little bit differently. Stay tuned for the Harper's Weekly News in review. But in the meantime, I wanted to present you with some more important facts that seem to be more relevant for us right now. Starting out with the Huffington Post by Harry Bradford. Median net worth in 2010 at lowest level since 1969. Stunning new research from a New York University economics professor reveals just how wide the chasm between the rich and everyone else has grown over the past few decades. In 2010, median net worth in the U.S. hits its lowest point since 1969 at $57,000, according to a recent study by NYU professor Edward Wolfe, who studied Americans' net worth from 1983 to 2010. During that same period, income inequality skyrocketed in the U.S., Wolfe found, largely thanks to the housing bust, which took a significant bite out of middle-class Americans' assets. Wolfe found that while middle-income earners lost 18% of their net worth, those in the top 1% increased their wealth by 71% over the same time period, according to Wolfe's report. The findings bring into sharper relief existing evidence that average Americans are getting squeezed ever tighter, while the country's wealthiest watched their fortune explode. In 2010, the annual median wage fell to $26,364, its lowest level since 1999, according to a separate study. The decline in wages may have, in part, contributed to growing wealth inequality, resulting in a member of the 1%'s worth equaling 288 times that of the median U.S. household, the Economic Policy Institute found in a report released in September. The Great Recession is responsible for much of that disparity, with the wealth of the median family declining a record 38.8% between 2007 and 2010. Those between the ages of 35 and 44 were hit particularly hard. Partly as a result, half of Americans' households now possess just 1% of the nation's wealth. Next, also important, this also from the Huffington Post, the blog. This article by Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor, The American Prospect. The fiscal myth. As President Obama gets closer to making his deal with the Republicans on the budget, the most important thing to keep in mind is that the fiscal cliff is an artificially contrived trap. Were it not for the two Bush wars and the two Bush tax cuts and the House Republican games of brinkmanship with the routine extension of the debt ceiling, there would be no fiscal cliff. Rather, there would be a normal, relatively short-term increase in the deficit resulting from a deep recession and the drop in government revenues that it produces. When the economy recovered, the deficit would return to sustainable levels. In the meantime, these deficits are necessary and useful to maintain public spending as a tonic to the economy. In addition, there are two entirely extraneous questions that do not belong in this debate. Whether Social Security requires any long-term adjustment to assure its solvency, and if so, what kind, and how to restrain the long-term growth in Medicare spending. In fact, if we can get back to full employment, there is no Social Security crisis because Social Security is financed by taxes on payrolls. In the Clinton era, when we had full employment, the crisis kept receding. If we want a little extra insurance, we can lift the cap on income subject to payroll taxes. Medicare spending is a long-term problem that requires major structural reforms. Reducing benefits or raising the eligibility age in the heat of an artificially contrived fiscal crisis is the wrong way to proceed. Obama's Affordable Care Act will keep Medicare at roughly the present level of spending relative to GDP, too high, but not an imminent catastrophe. The strategy of the right wing has been to blur these several distinct issues into a single grand fiscal crisis, the better to reduce government spending and especially to cut Social Security and Medicare. The right wing in this case is a two-headed beast. The Republican right wing is mainly interested in defending tax cuts for the rich and reducing social spending generally, while the deficit hawks of the center-right want to achieve budget balance and weaken Social Security and Medicare. And since Social Security and Medicare are phenomenally popular, so much the better for the Republicans if they can trick the Democrats into sharing responsibility for the deed. A further piece of mischief is the premise that we somehow need a 10-year budget deal that reduces the projected deficit by something like $4 to $5 trillion. We don't. What we need is an economic recovery. If we get a recovery with something close to full employment, the deficit naturally comes down as revenues to and current levels of public spending are entirely sustainable, especially if we get back to the pre-Bush tax levels on the wealthy. So if we limit the debate to the real subject at hand, namely how to avoid a massive fiscal contraction next year when all the Bush tax cuts expire, President Obama holds a very strong hand. He has made it clear that he will not tolerate extending the Bush tax cuts for the top 2% at a cost of cutting back valued government outlays for everyone else. But he does want to extend the lower tax rates for the bottom 98%. This puts the Republicans in the position of allowing everyone's taxes to increase in order to preserve the cuts for the top 2%. Not a happy position politically. And Obama has said he is willing to play hardball, let the economy go over the cliff of a general increase in rates in order to force the Republicans to back down. The Republicans have been tying themselves in knots in order to find other sources of additional revenue to plug the budget gap so that they can keep their pledge to Grover Norquist never to increase tax rates. Funny how the Norquist pledge is a one-way ratchet. Republicans can vote to cut tax rates on the premium that the economy needs the temporary stimulus, but then if they vote to restore the old rates, they are in violation of the pledge. You can see where that leads. But there is just not enough money for this budget deal unless a tax rate hike on the rich is part of the package. Restoring the pre-Bush tax rates on the top 2% would raise about $1.2 trillion over a decade. Raising capital gains rates to those of ordinary income and closing other loopholes that benefited mainly the wealthy would raise, at most, less than another trillion. Even with those tax hikes, Obama and the Republicans would be more than $2 trillion short of the stated goal of cutting the deficit by at least $4 trillion over a decade. And there is where the deeper mischief of this $4 trillion goal and its relation to Social Security and Medicare comes in. Neither party wants significant budget cuts in the next year or two when the recovery is too fragile to stand even a smaller fiscal contraction. So the Republicans, Obama, and the Democratic budget hawks like Erskine Bowles and retiring Budget Committee Chairman Senator Kent Conrad all want to backload the spending cuts, have them bite late in the decade. It just happens the Social Security Medicare cuts fill that bill perfectly. Cut social insurance several years from now, and you delay the political outcry until Obama has left office. You also delay the fiscal impact, and you leave room for a bit of other government spending. But cutting Social Security and Medicare for the sale of an arbitrary and useless budgetary reduction of $4 trillion and as a solution to an entirely contrived fiscal crisis is bad policy. It is bad economic policy and worse social policy. And for Democrats, it is dumb politics. If Republicans want to be the ones to attack Americans' two most valued social programs, Obama should let them go right ahead until they march off their own fiscal cliff. And if the president is too determined to get a deal to appreciate what a strong hand he has, then it is up to Democrats in Congress and the progressive community outside Washington to make sure that Obama doesn't follow Republicans off their cliff. Robert Kuttner is co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos. His latest book is A Presidency in Peril. Okay, I have one more little short article for you people. This one is from the New York Times. It's from the opinion pages. This is an article by Warren Buffett, op-ed contributor, A Minimum Tax for the Wealthy. Suppose that an investor you admire and trust comes to you with an investment idea. This is a good one, he says enthusiastically. I'm in it, and I think you should be too. Would your reply possibly be this? Well, it all depends on what my tax rate will be on the gain. You're saying we're going to make. If the taxes are too high, I would rather leave the money in my savings account, earning a quarter of 1%. Only in Grover Norquist's imagination does such a response exist. Between 1951 and 1954, when the capital gains rate was 25% and marginal rates on dividends reached 91% in extreme cases, I sold securities and did pretty well. In the years from 1956 to 1969, the top marginal rate fell moderately, but was still a lofty 70%. And the tax rate on capital gains inched up to 27.5%. I was managing funds for investors then. Never did anyone mention taxes as a reason to forego an investment opportunity that I offered. Under those burdensome rates, moreover, both employment and the gross domestic product, a measure of the nation's economic output, increased at a rapid clip. The middle class and the rich alike gained ground. So let's forget about the rich and ultra-rich going on strike and stuffing their ample funds under their mattresses if gas, capital gains rates, and ordinary income rates are increased. The ultra-rich, including me, will forever pursue investment opportunities. And wow, do we have plenty to invest. The Forbes 400, the wealthiest individuals in America, hit a new group record for wealth this year, $1.7 trillion. That's more than five times the $300 billion total in 1992. In recent years, my gang has been leaving the middle class in the dust. A huge tailwind from tax cuts has pushed us along. In 1992, the tax paid by the 400 highest incomes in the United States, a different universe from the Forbes list, averaged 26.4% of adjusted gross income. In 2009, the most recent year reported, the rate was 19.9%. It's nice to have friends in high places. The group's average income in 2009 was $202 million, which works out to a wage of $97,000 per hour based on a 40-hour work week. I'm assuming they're paid during lunch hours. Yet more than a quarter of these ultra-wealthy paid less than 15% of their take in combined federal income and payroll taxes. Half of this crew paid less than 20%, and brace yourself, a few paid actually nothing. This outrage points to the necessity for more than a simple revision in upper-end tax rates, though that's the place to start. I support President Obama's proposal to eliminate the Bush tax cuts for high-income taxpayers. However, I prefer a cutoff point somewhat above $250,000, maybe $500,000 or so. Additionally, we need Congress right now to enact a minimum tax rate on high incomes. I would suggest 30% of taxable income between $1 million and $10 million, and 35% on amounts above that. Now, this is Warren Buffett talking, okay? A plain and simple rule like that will block the efforts of lobbyists, lawyers, and contribution-hungry legislators to keep the ultra-rich paying rates well below those incurred by people with income just a tiny fraction of ours. Only a minimum tax on very high incomes will prevent the stated tax rate from being eviscerated by these warriors for the wealthy. Above all, we should not postpone these changes in the name of reforming the tax code. True, changes are badly needed. We need to get rid of arrangements like carried interest that enable income from labor to be magically converted into capital gains. And it's sickening that a Cayman Islands mail drop can be central to tax maneuvering by wealthy individuals and corporations. but the reform of such complexities should not promote delay in our correcting simple and expensive inequities. We can't let those who want to protect the privileged get away with insisting that we do nothing until we can do everything. Our government's goal should be to bring in revenue of 18.5% of GDP and spend about 21% of GDP, levels that have been attained over extended periods in the past and can clearly be reached again. As the math makes clear, this won't stem our budget deficits. In fact, it will continue them. But assuming even conservative projections about inflation and economic growth, this ratio of revenue to spending will keep America's debt stable in relation to the country's economic output. In the last fiscal year, we were far away from this fiscal balance, bringing in 15.5% of the GDP in revenue and spending 22.4%. Correcting our course will require major concessions by both Republicans and Democrats. All of America is waiting for Congress to offer a realistic and concrete plan for getting back to this fiscally sound path. Nothing less is acceptable. In the meantime, maybe you'll run into someone with a terrific investment idea who won't go forward with it because of the tax he would owe when it succeeds. Send him my way. Let me unburden him. Warren E. Buffett is the chairman and chief executive of Berkshire Hathaway. Okay, now, at last, for your amusement, Harper's Weekly Review, November 27, 2012. In Tel Aviv, a bomb exploded on a city bus, and an Israeli man carrying a knife, an axe, a pitchfork, and a red bag attacked a guard at the U.S. Embassy. In Cairo, representatives of Israel and Hamas brokered a ceasefire agreement, ending 8 days of conflict in Gaza that had resulted in the deaths of 5 Israelis and 162 Palestinians. This is a point on the way to a great defeat, said Khaled Meshkal, the exiled chairman of Hamas. Israel failed in all of its objectives. At a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who served as Israel's proxy negotiator in Cairo, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would continue to take whatever action is necessary to protect his people. This, he said, is something I don't have to explain to Americans. Clinton praised Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, Hamas's representative in the discussions, for his responsibility and leadership. The next day, Morsi issued a decree that expanded his presidential powers, allowing him to fire Egypt's prosecutor general and exempt himself from judicial review. The Egyptian Judges Club threatened to strike. Protesters in Alexandria set fire to the headquarters of the ruling Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party. And thousands of demonstrators, some armed with stones and Molotov cocktails, gathered in Tahrir Square. God willing, we will remove Morsi, said one man, as we did Mubarak. Peace, one of two turkeys pardoned by President Obama last Thanksgiving, fell ill and was euthanized. Liberty continued to thrive. The Free Syrian Army captured a special forces base near Aleppo, seizing 5 tanks, 2 armored vehicles, 2 rocket launchers, 2 artillery cannons, and a large stockpile of mortars and rifles. There has never been a battle before, said General Ahmad Al-Faj, with this much booty. Rebel soldiers also took control of a military airport outside Damascus. Watch, people, said a fighter in a video showing medics attending to a government soldier. Watch Assad's dogs, how we're treating them with tenderness. At least 112 workers died in a factory fire in Bangladesh, and 14 workers were killed in a gas leak explosion at a hot pot restaurant in northern China. Roman students protested cuts in education spending. Royalists in Bangkok marched against the prime minister, who they claimed had ignored insults to the Thai monarchy. And Madrid's trash collectors went on strike, prompting local residents to dump their garbage on the doorsteps of banks. Make sure you check, tweeted a protester, that it's not where someone sleeps. New York police were investigating the provenance of 2 corpses discovered in two parks in Queens by workers cleaning up after Hurricane Sandy. And South Pacific explorers bound for Sandy Island, which Google Maps identified as being midway between Australia and New Caledonia, found only ocean. Time, said Marlene Moses, chairwoman of the Alliance of Small Island States, is clearly not on our side. Mexico and the United States reached a new deal to share water from the Colorado River, and Mexican President Felipe Calderon suggested removing Estados Unidos from his country's official name. A man from Yonkers died clowning at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and spectators on Manhattan's Upper West Side found shredded police department documents amid the confetti. The parade's organizers provided free transportation to residents of Rockaway Beach. It's nice for the city to treat us, said one man, when we have nothing. Black Friday began on Thursday. We'll miss the actual being there with family, said a Michigan woman who spent Thanksgiving camped outside a Best Buy. But we'll have the rest of the weekend for that. A milk truck driver in Wisconsin ran over two cows. A deer in White House, Texas, chased two men into the bed of a pickup truck, then ate a pack of cigarettes, and scientists reported that apes have midlife crisis. An explosion in Springfield, Massachusetts, damaged 42 buildings, blowing out the windows of a tattoo parlor and flattening a scores gentlemen's club. And a German woman was accused of trying to smother her boyfriend with her double D cup breasts. Treasure, the man quoted his girlfriend as saying, I wanted your death to be as pleasurable as possible. This by Ryan Liebenthal from harpers.org. And that has been the Kill Radio Weekly News. Thanks to the whole Kill Radio Weekly News team. All of you out there, have a great week. Be good to each other and stay out of the news.